And day one of the 2020 legislative session in Olympia. One of the top issues this year, homelessness. Sky Radio's Hannah Scott reports that one lawmaker believes that that has to include addressing the prolific offender problem.
Governor Inslee and lawmakers have made it clear homelessness is a top priority for the short 2020 legislative session that starts today. Republican State Senator Steve O'Bannon agrees but says to truly address this issue, Washington must step up to help those most in need.
We have a number of individuals who are out in the community who are have serious mental illness. We see them all. They're disoriented. They're talking to themselves. They come into contact with law enforcement. They have long rap sheets, sometimes dozens and dozens of crimes that they've been charged with, but they are not able to prosecute them for one reason or another.
He's talking about those who fall through the cracks between the criminal justice, behavioral health, and human services systems, commonly known as prolific offenders.
We have a gap in the services that we provide to those with significant mental illness or drug addictions. If someone is an imminent threat to themselves or others, legally you can put them in an inpatient setting on an involuntary basis. But once they no longer meet that definition, they're released. But that doesn't mean they're well. It just means they're not an imminent threat. So how do you deal with these individuals?
O'Bannon believes he's got the answer.
What my bill would do would be to create a new form of guardianship, someone who would be appointed by the city or county to oversee the mental health care or drug treatment for an individual who fits into this category, so they can no longer refuse services.
His bill would create a pilot program for Kings, Snohomish, and Pierce counties, specifically targeting this small group of the homeless population, similar to a new program in California.
It didn't originate in my mind. It's actually now being piloted in California, of all places. So this isn't an idea coming from some red state. This is San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego that are dealing with the same kinds of hard-to-treat individuals. And they know they need a tool like this, because without it, no care is really going to be meaningfully provided.
There's already strong support among many Republicans in the legislature, but Democrats at last week's AP legislative preview had not had a chance to see the bill yet, so they were reluctant to weigh in. But Seattle Democratic Representative Nicole Macri did have this to offer.
In my experience, which is quite vast, I have found that forced treatment typically is not very durable over time.
But O'Bannon believes critical lawmakers will change their minds when this gets a hearing, which he expects it will.
I talked to a couple of providers, and they say this is exactly what we need. I don't think this will be a heavy lift once policy officials hear from providers.
And Hannah joins us live. Is this the first time then there will be a statewide rule that allows this kind of involuntary treatment?
Well, we already have an involuntary treatment for those who, even when we're talking about substance abuse, for those who are deemed to be a danger to themselves or others, an imminent danger. This would change that. And again, it's more of a guardianship, conservatorship kind of thing. I believe the terminology in the bill is cannot care for themselves. So it's kind of a lower standard to meet. And it's not necessarily that you're going to send somebody to Western State. It's going to be in a community-based setting. So it's a pilot program for Pierce, Snohomish, King counties. And in order for the county to ask for this, because it would be run by cities and counties, they would have to prove that they want to have the resources, the community facilities, the treatment available to help with these people. And it doesn't necessarily, I don't think, have to be an inpatient treatment. But it would be a first of its kind. And it's just something that just passed in California in October. They're just rolling out their pilot programs now.
So since we have a model in California, do we know what kind of facilities we're talking about? Because when you say community-based, does that mean the state buys like a home in the neighborhood? And because if it's involuntary, presumably you need someone there to make sure people don't just up and leave. That implies.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. So what does this look like?
It looks like, I believe LA, San Diego, and San Francisco have this, and it's a little bit different there than what it's going to expect it to look like here. But so, for example, in Seattle, we have a lot of permanent supportive housing and more coming online every day. So it requires that the bill specifically says you have to make sure there's enough of that type of housing available or an immediate housing available. And that type of housing always has somebody there, not necessarily a security guard, but somebody who's like a 24/7 treatment kind of atmosphere person, in any of those types of things. So it's not like you're just coming in and out of an like a doctor's visit type of a thing. You're going to be in a place where there's somebody watching you all the time.
And when you get to these questions like taking care of yourself and making up for, you know, broken families, that is a long-term thing. How long in the San Francisco program, do you know how long people are typically in this program before they're ready to go out on their own again?
I do not. And it's until you're found that you're able to care for yourself and you can, you know, you're going back to work or doing things like this. And, you know, there's a noticeable difference. I know in order to be considered to go to be someone subjected to this, you have to have had 5 or more detentions for evaluation and treatment in the last 12 months. So that's something that you often see with prolific offenders, right? They're referred out. So that's the standard to getting into it. As far as getting out to it, I don't see anything in the language of the bill that says anything specific.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll have plenty of people who qualify for getting into it. My only question mm-hmm. is, you know, if they have an experience on how long it takes to actually, what do we say, repair people and then send them out on their own.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and this is something that you and I have talked about in the past, Dave, and do we compel treatment? That is a really hard sell for some folks, for some homeless advocates and for folks who really kind of advocate for those prolific offenders. You know, is it more humane to leave them out on the street the way that they are now? And we're talking about a relatively small group of the homeless population, and that was the situation in California as well. 50 to 100, I think, is San Francisco's goal of the mm-hmm. people that they're expecting to deal with this program. So and I think we'd see something similar here in Seattle, but there are going to be those who are against this. There are those who say it goes too far against civil rights, you know, invading of civil rights. So we'll see a lot of debate. Should this get a hearing, he does expect that it will, though.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Another caffeine study is out, and this one is good news. At least for lab rats. Let's consult the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD, brought to you by Pro Club, the region's premier health club and wellness destination. This has to do with caffeine's effect on how much fat you retain.
Yeah, this is an interesting study because it actually showed a beneficial effect to caffeine. And oftentimes you'll see that the research tends to focus on the negative effects of caffeine. But it is known that in the body, caffeine activates an enzyme called lipoprotein lipase, which is responsible for the breakdown of our fat cells. But it's surprising that that doesn't get talked about more. But actually, this recent study that came out of Illinois, they actually looked at caffeine of different sources. They looked at naturally occurring caffeine that was present in mate tea, but they also looked at synthetic caffeine. And they gave it to a group of rats. And I don't usually like to talk about studies where you were extrapolating from animals to humans. But I think this one is important because caffeine is so prevalent. And I think this probably does, in fact, apply. And what they found was is that there was an anti-obesity effect to caffeine, which some of us may not find at all surprising because we know that when we consume caffeine, it suppresses our appetite. But actually, they found something different. They found that it wasn't just related to having appetite suppression, but that, in fact, it also altered our gene expression.
I thought that was the interesting part, was that this wasn't the fact that it makes your heart race, or as you point out, makes you less hungry, but it actually controls the expression of certain genes that are crucial to forming those fats in your body.
That's exactly right. And in this case, it actually decreased the amount of proteins that were responsible for the formation of fat. And it reduced it by 20 to 40%. And that actually translated into the amount of fat that was present in these rats. So it's pretty interesting because it suggests that by consuming caffeine, you're actually decreasing your body's ability to actually produce fat cells. And that is what's responsible for the anti-obesity effect and not necessarily the suppression of appetite that comes along with consumption of caffeine. Now, having said that, overall, the benefit may be both, that you get some appetite suppression and you get some decrease in the formation of fat cells itself.
And this wasn't just about the caffeine found in coffee. So it would apply wherever you get your caffeine, whether it's coffee, tea, or presumably an energy drink?
Right. Yeah, they were clever about that, right? So they actually didn't look at just naturally occurring caffeine. They looked at synthetic caffeine, and they found that irrespective of the source source of the caffeine, the effect was the same. So it's actually the chemical caffeine that is having the effect rather than something else that's found naturally in one of these other products.
So is there still a downside to caffeine, even in light of the study?
Well, this is where I think the research gets confusing. And it depends whether you're looking at science or you're looking at observational studies. There was a study out of the Mayo Clinic. It was an observational study. And, you know, they found that more than 4 cups of coffee consumed a day was linked to early death. And they said it was about a 21% increase. Because coffee raises your metabolism, it can also affect your blood pressure. So is it actually linked to long-term hypertension? Not necessarily. However, it could be related to an acute or transient increase in your blood pressure. Caffeine is, you know, also linked to gout. It's supposedly linked to breast cysts in women. It is a diuretic, so you can have a dehydration. And you know, it obviously causes headaches and indigestion and reflux in people. So there are theoretically a number of other problems that are related to caffeine. But again, I think what was clever about this study, and we need to think about further when we evaluate some of these other studies and the downsides to caffeine, is it actually the caffeine that's causing the problem? Or is it other things that are present in the beverage that you're consuming, such as coffee, that are the problem? So I know, for example, that a lot of people who have stomach upset or, you know, gastric reflux from consuming coffee can consume energy drinks, present speaker included. Hmm. And so it can't be the caffeine. It has to be the other
things. Something else.
Yeah. Right. And as we've talked about before, coffee has 150 different other chemicals in it. So it's not just the caffeine that's present in coffee. So, you know, it's sort of hard to know exactly what the cause is. What I like about this study, and I think it was important to talk about, was the fact that this was really getting down to the science. So what does caffeine do at the cellular level? And it is, in fact, affecting gene expression and affecting the proteins that those genes encode for. And those proteins are actually involved in the formation of fats. So I think this is really quite interesting, and a lot could be learned from it and potentially could play a role in the future development of drugs and so forth to help with obesity.
So coffee is still associated with early death, but thanks to the caffeine content, at least you'll die thin.
Exactly.
Got it. Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Thanks, Dr. Cohen.
Thanks, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross. Let's talk market timing with CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Let me guess, you're going to tell us that market timing is a bad thing.
You are so wise.
Yes.
Unfortunately, even though most of us understand this, we consistently believe that it doesn't apply to us. And so I was thinking about this last week as there was so much talk early in the week about how stocks were coming under pressure and events in the Middle East meant that the inevitable recession was coming. Gold was soaring. Stocks were sinking. And people were really starting to buy into this again. And by the end of the week, I was like, oh, look, as if it never happened. Poof. Stock markets actually ended the week higher. So I think that it's a good lesson in just the last couple of weeks that it is very difficult to predict short-term movements in the markets. And over the long term, if you just stick with your game plan, you're probably going to be happier.
Okay, well, how do you write your game plan then? Because you've said that many times. What should the game plan, how do you actually make a decent return at a time when interest rates, for people who just want to save their money in a you know, a little savings account or a CD, are still below 2%.
Yeah, I think that it's very difficult, okay? But I do think it starts with figuring out what are your financial goals. And maybe your financial goals are very simple. Don't pick too many. You know, one might be, I just want to get out of my student loan debt. The second might be, I want to start putting more money into my retirement account so that I can figure out how to stop working at some point. And the third could be that you just want to be able to gather up a little bit of extra money in an emergency reserve fund because maybe you're going to be a career changer. Any of those goals then has sort of sub-action items to get there. And I think that for most of them, when we're talking about long-term investing, it's pretty easy. All you need to do is figure out, if I'm a long-term investor, if I can manage a little bit of risk, how much money goes into stocks versus bonds versus cash versus maybe commodities or real estate. And there are so many programs online. Every investment house has this. And then you put that in that plan into place and you don't mess around with it. In other words, you don't let the news cycle dictate what happens to your investments.
So you're not picking individual stocks then. You're putting it into some kind of Dow Jones fund.
Yeah. Exactly. You just pick an index fund. It's cheap. It's efficient. It's the best way to get you where you want to go. You know, I've grown up around traders my whole life. And some of these people who go on TV and they talk about this stock or that stock, you ask them about their personal portfolios. And guess what? They're in index funds and maybe they have like sort of a fun money account. But generally speaking, they're really boring. So if it's good enough for the professionals, if it's good enough for the academics who show us time and time again that, in fact, just putting money in low-cost index funds works over time, why are we messing around with this?
I have to confess, I have a little hobby fund.
Yeah, that's okay.
That's okay because sometimes, it's really pretty arbitrary. I'll see somebody invent something that sounds like it's a promising thing and they work for a company. So I say, okay, let's throw a few bucks into that and see what happens.
Okay, so there's two things about that. If you're going to have a fun money fund, or maybe it's just I'm going to learn about the stock market with investments, what I would start with is, number one, what is the amount of money I'm willing to lose? That's the amount of money that's in that account. And maybe it's 2 or 3 or 5% of your total investments. That's it. No more than that.
That's it.
And then you've got to decide, do I want to do this in a taxable account or a non-taxable account? The upside of using the taxable account is that when you inevitably screw up and lose money, you can deduct that tax deduction. If you are a genius investor, using a retirement account can be helpful because you don't have to worry about capital gains.
I see. Okay. So in other words, the money you put in your fund account is the money that if it burned up in a sudden fire, you wouldn't miss it.
That's exactly right. Think of it as like I'm going to the casino and this is the amount of money I can lose.
Okay. That's
I hear you're not liking that advice, are you, Dave?
I read that, you know, what Warren Buffett did, for example, was he looked for companies that were solid companies that were giving steady financial returns and, you know, nothing flashy, but something that would over time, like AT&T, you know, it seems to pump out a dividend every month, every quarter on a regular basis.
Well, I would also point you to Warren Buffett's advice to his heirs, which he wrote in his investment letter a couple of years ago. And he said, when I die, what you should do is put all of this money into an S&P 500 index fund.
I see. I didn't read
that
part.
So I guess, in other words, what I'm saying to you is you are not Warren Buffett.
Gotcha. CBS, thank you for yet another ruthless insight. CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Take care.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness, sponsored by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. If I've learned one thing after more than 3 years, I had to look back. It's been 3 years of sharing doses of kindness. Can you believe that, Dave?
Wow.
You feel better?
Yes, I do.
Feel better having heard all these stories?
I do.
That's the point. It's that I've learned that you need to look no further than kids to figure out how to be a decent human being. This story takes us to Hoover, Alabama. 10-year-old Foster Dudley was at Target with his mother when he found something.
We walked down the aisle, and we found an envelope, and then we opened it, and we saw
$900. $900. $100 bills. That could get you a lot of video games. There was a bank receipt, too. So he had the owner's name. They decided, of course, they had to return it. But the bank was closed, so they got back to Target. And with the help of the store manager, they were able to find the owner of those $900, Verdina Ball. And the two met last week.
It was awesome to give her the money back. I felt very proud of myself and happy that I gave it back. And I felt very powerful after I did it. And then I was a celebrity at Target.
It was a celebrity. The act of kindness and character, it did draw a crowd. Foster ended up taking pictures with people who wanted to remember the kid with integrity. Target was impressed, too. They gave Foster a $100 gift card for showing that good character.
There you go. Time for our Sports Insiders from Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Here's Stacy Ross. Good morning, Stacy.
Good morning.
Sometimes I wish you weren't so good at your job.
I know.
On Friday.
I know. I'm so good at it.
I asked you to predict the game, and let's roll the audio evidence.
I think that the home field advantage for the Packers and the health of their team might be too much for Seattle. So I'm going to say 28 to 24. Packers.
Wow.
Final score 28-23. So you all but nailed it.
Unfortunately. I think when they entered the halftime 21-3, trailing 21-3, I was thinking, no way is that prediction going to be met. And I was not expecting them to win because I thought the Packers were the healthier team, the better team going into that game, at least on paper, right? And then they started getting back into it, and I thought, why did I doubt them? Why did I question this? Why did I pick the Packers to win? I'm such an idiot. I've seen so many of these games. And they really did get so close to it. And I think my biggest feeling leaving it is that they once again, I think, impressed me and surprised me, and Russell Wilson just put on a complete, like a clinic in the second half.
Absolutely. And it was just the little things, I think, that prevented them from getting that next touchdown or whatever they needed to defeat the Packers. So what exactly would you point out for the team that they need to improve on next year? Is it simply because we have a lot of injuries, or was there, you know, I know Russell Wilson got sacked, mm-hmm. and it was just the little things, you know?
No, you're totally right, Colleen. I think a lot of it is injuries because of those little things. You look at, you know, what happens if instead of Malik Turner, who's been really promising, you have, you know, more than two weapons at receiver, and then you don't have a drop there. Or you look at Jacob Hollister, who again had a really impressive season, but you had a starting tight end who was injured earlier this year that might have made that catch. Likewise, you look at some of the sacks and pressure that you got. Well, you're down to your third string left guard, a very injured starting left tackle, and your second string center. So you're dealing with a lot of injuries as a team. And so I think some of the criticism I saw after the game was, why did they punt on 4th and 11? Which, by the way, I understand the argument for going for it. I also understand the argument for feeling like if we don't get this on 4th and 11 from our own territory, this game is done. At least we have a chance with all of our timeouts and, you know, with 2+ minutes left to get the ball back. So I don't think it's that decision that cost them the game. I think it's the injuries that they had. I mean, if you have Chris Carson, you can establish a run game. So mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough.
Who thought they come this far? I mean, when you look at the number of starters they lost,
exactly.
Who thought they even get this far? So I was
no.
I have no criticism of what happened, except things. It came down to Jimmy Graham and where they spotted the ball on that final play.
Of all people,
yeah.
I definitely think it was short. But what are you going to do?
Yeah, Coach Carroll remained unbowed, sounded really upbeat.
This is the start of this team. I think this is, it feels like 2012.
And what do you think he meant by that?
I think he means that he was talking specifically about the feeling on the sideline, the feeling that he gets from this group. In the 2012 game, I think he was really impressed with the feeling that people thought we're back in this. They never
felt defeated,
even though they were such a young
Atlanta
team. Yes, this was the loss to Atlanta where they scored 4 touchdowns in the second half, came back from a 20-0 deficit. In this game, I think he feels like it's a young team. They're buying in and buying into his mentality that you're never out of it, that you can always compete. And that's so important to him. And I think he was really impressed by that. And post game sounded very touched by the demeanor and environment that this team has built. And so I think that there are some important similarities there. I think the big difference is that the 2012 team had some big players on defense that were about to become stars. They had Richard Sherman, Earl Thomas, Cam Chancellor. And then the 2019 team, they really struggled on defense and have a couple pieces to pick up before they can be. And Danny O'Neill mentioned this in his article for 710 Sports. They have a couple pieces to pick up before you would expect them to be where they were last night.
Stacey, since you're so good at predictions, does Marshawn come back next season?
I don't think so. Okay. No, I think this was very much a, yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
sorry,
well,
guys.
We'll hear more from him next hour. He actually waxed philosophical and spoke for more than 10 seconds. So we'll play some of that for you. Stacey, thank you. Great prediction.
Thank you, guys. Bye.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Let's talk about deep fakes, which we've discussed before. These are videos which look like they involve real people, but in fact may not. And there's an indication that this deep fake technology may have been released into the wild. So let's check with the editor-at-large for TechCrunch, Josh Constein. And first of all, describe what kind of deep fakery are we talking about here? What is the process exactly?
So deep fakes are a way of using artificial intelligence to graft an image of one person's face onto video of somebody else. And so it can make somebody look like they're saying something that they haven't or doing something that they haven't. And typically, this is a very complicated process that requires a fair amount of engineering knowledge. But now the company behind the popular social media app, TikTok, has developed a very easy way to create these kind of deep fakes and use them in its Chinese app, Douyin. And that technology could come to the U.S. app, TikTok, eventually.
So this is something that would fit on just an ordinary smartphone, then?
Exactly. Normally, you would need a real computer to do this kind of complicated video editing and using the engineering tools to basically blend the edges of somebody's face into the head of somebody else, so it looks like they're saying something that they didn't. But with TikTok's version, basically all you do is you take a biometric scan of your face, similar to when you set up Face ID on an iPhone. You move your face around in front of the camera. Then it can take that face and put it onto the body of somebody else and manipulate your face to give you different facial expressions or make it look like you're saying something. And this all happens in a matter of seconds. And you just pick a video from the library that Douyin offers, and instantly you're the star of that video.
Wow. And yeah, they have a library of videos that they offer, and they insist that this can't be abused because, again, there's a specific set of videos that you can use for the process, and you must be clearly in front of your phone, only doing it for your benefit. Are you allowed to share? I assume you're not allowed to share these, though, right?
Oh, no, that's the whole point, is that you post these videos and broadcast them like you would post on Instagram. And yes, it's something where you do have to be actually in front of the camera. You can't use a photo of somebody else or something from your camera roll. But that doesn't mean that you can't still do something that could be frightening or scary. It's true that because TikTok and Douyin control the source material and are only making sort of benign videos available, instead of the kind of typical fodder you see for deepfakes, which include videos of public figures or heads of state making addresses, or actually pornography, where people will use deepfakes to graft somebody else's face into a pornographic video so it looks like somebody else is starring in it that might never do something like that. And because TikTok is only offering a limited set of videos, you won't be able to do that kind of misinformation, but it could still cause huge problems if TikTok and Douyin decide to make videos that maybe they shouldn't available in that library.
Now, I understand that these are watermarked so that they are identifiable as fake.
They are watermarked to show that they are part of this company's app, but it doesn't necessarily detail that this is fake. Hmm. In China, the government actually requires that any deepfake video be labeled as such, whereas in the U.S., we don't have any laws about this to protect us yet. The big worry here is that this company, TikTok, which is owned by ByteDance, one of the world's biggest private startups that exists in China, they're an artificial intelligence leader. The worry is that they will be collecting biometric scans of people's faces from whoever their users are. And these are the same kind of scans you use to be able to unlock a Face ID or facial recognition system to unlock a phone. And this is a real security concern. Eventually, we may see that people try to protect the biometric scan of their face the same way we think about trying to protect our social security number today.
So this could be like, this app could be just what? Bait, flypaper for your biometric information.
The company hasn't really shown that it's doing anything especially nefarious with this kind of data just yet. But there are concerns because the Chinese government, which works with Douyin and ByteDance, has certainly censored videos that have existed on that app, ones that talk about protests or social issues in China. And the question really is, do we trust this company with some of the most sensitive personal data that could be used to unlock our phones in the future? Do we want to trust this to a company that the U.S. government has no control over?
Now, this has not been released yet. Is that correct? You just found out about this by examining some embedded code somewhere?
A tipster sent me some information showing that buried in the Android version of the Chinese and American versions of TikTok, there was code that could be used to activate this feature. And in the Chinese version, it was actually far enough along that these researchers were able to activate the feature and try it out, though it's not available to the public. And to date, TikTok says that this feature will not be launched in the U.S., but there's no telling what could happen with that in the future.
All right. We are on notice. The prediction that these deepfakes would exist, it's just standing off stage, just behind the curtain, and could be essentially turned on at any time.
Exactly. I think this is going to be something that the public is going to have to learn to spot. We're going to need higher media literacy. It's no longer that if you see a video of somebody saying something that you can truly believe it's them. And that has huge implications for how we deal with misinformation around elections or politics, but also how we deal with our personal relationships. Like who knows if evidence in an extramarital affair was actually faked using this kind of deepfakes technology.
Yikes. Josh Constein is the editor-at-large at TechCrunch. Josh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.